himself.
Alexander of Aphrodisias, a philosopher during the late 1st and early 2nd centuries, discussed self-fulfilling predictions. In the story of Oedipus, Apollo makes a prophecy to King Laius that his future son will kill him. Some of Alexander's contemporaries believed that Apollo's prophecy caused Laius to try to kill his son, which eventually led Oedipus to kill his father, without knowing it was his father. Alexander gives a number of arguments against this position, but one response is telling. Well, if someone says these things, how does he preserve prophecy? For prophecy is thought to be prediction of the things that are going to happen. But they make Apollo the author of the things he predicts. How is this not the deed of him who prophesied, rather than revelation of the things that were going to be? We can imagine someone seeming to foretell the future, but really just causing the events that lead to the predicted future. Alexander says it's not a genuine prophecy unless it's already true that those events are going to happen, and the speaker predicts them because he knows they'll happen. If the words are simply an attempt to manipulate events, they're not a genuine prophecy. A real prophecy could cause what it describes, but this isn't true of Trelawney's first prophecy. It didn't cause Voldemort to go after Harry. He could have gone after Neville, but Dumbledore notices he chose Harry as a half-blood like himself. He saw himself in you before he had ever seen you. What made him choose Harry wasn't the prophecy, which didn't cause him to go after anyone. Dumbledore suggests that if Voldemort had heard the whole prophecy, he might not have been so hasty. When Harry asks why Voldemort hadn't waited to figure out which one it was, or, I might add, killed both, Dumbledore says Voldemort had incomplete information because his spy, later revealed as Severus Snape, was thrown out of the room halfway through the prophecy.
Consequently, he could not warn his master that to attack you would be to risk transferring power to you, again marking you as his equal. So Voldemort never knew that there might be danger in attacking you, that it might be wise to wait or learn more. He did not know that you would have power the Dark Lord knows not.
The prophecy by itself couldn't have made Voldemort do anything. He heard some of the prophecy, but it didn't ensure anything. It couldn't control how much Snape heard. If Voldemort had heard the rest, he might not have chosen to do anything. So, it doesn't seem as if the self-fulfilling interpretation of prophecies is a good way to distinguish real predictions from Professor Trelawney's usual prophecies. Destiny. In a 2007 interview with a Dutch newspaper, J.K. Rowling said that her use of Professor Trelawney reflected her view that there's no such thing as destiny. What does this denial of destiny amount to? A compatibilist about freedom and predetermination thinks we can be free even if our choices are determined by things outside our control. Some compatibilists say there's just one possible outcome, the actual future. Other compatibilists speak of possible choices, meaning we can consider various options and then pick one, even if our deliberation is predetermined by things outside our control. A libertarian about freedom holds that we have options because there's nothing that guarantees our choices ahead of time. This is more than compatibilism allows, because the libertarian considers predetermined choices unfree. Some libertarians believe in a fixed future, meaning there are truths now about what will happen. You might have many possible futures open to you, even if there's only one actual future that will happen. Other libertarians, thinking that such truths about future choices would threaten our freedom, insist on an open future, where statements about our future free choices are neither true nor false until those choices are made. The most natural denial of destiny is the open future view. No future statements about people's free choices are true or false. Yet someone denying destiny could mean that there are possible futures open to us without denying that only one of them is the actual future. It's possible Rowling means just that, in which case she might even be a compatibilist, although this kind of language is more typical of a libertarian. Dumbledore tells Harry that the prophecy about him doesn't have to be fulfilled just because it's a real prophecy. Does Dumbledore mean there's no fact about whether it will be fulfilled, and it becomes a genuine prophecy only when the foretold event occurs or is guaranteed to happen? Or does he mean the prophecy doesn't make Harry or Voldemort do anything? What it predicts is the actual future, but other futures are possible. We need to delve more deeply into the Potter books to see what kind of destiny there is and isn't in Harry's world. A rodent's destiny. In Prisoner of Azkaban, Professor Trelawney makes a second real prediction. The Dark Lord lies alone and friendless, abandoned by his followers. His servant has been changed these 12 years. Tonight, before midnight, the servant will break free and set out to rejoin his master. The Dark Lord will rise again with his servant's aid, greater and more terrible than ever he was. Tonight, before midnight, the servant will set out to rejoin his master. If the prophecy that one of Voldemort's followers would go to him that night was overwhelmingly likely, then Wormtail must have been extremely likely to escape that night. Other followers who were capable of going were unlikely to try. If Remus Lupin had remembered to take his wolfsbane potion to manage his werewolf transformation, or someone had responded more quickly when Wormtail transformed, Wormtail might not have escaped. If a real prediction involves greater likelihood, this should be a likely outcome. It doesn't seem likely, so this particular prophecy is hard to see as fallible, but likely. The earlier prophecy is similar. Even if Voldemort was likely to go after Harry, how probable was it that Wormtail would become secret keeper at the last minute? Voldemort wouldn't otherwise have marked Harry and given him power the Dark Lord knows not. If Voldemort hadn't told Snape his plan, Snape wouldn't have begged for Lily Potter to be spared, and Lily wouldn't have had to make a voluntary protective sacrifice. Again, Harry wouldn't have been marked. Thus, this prediction also seems to be real in some stronger sense than simply being likely but fallible. Time travel and fixed time. To make sense of Rowling's views on prophecy and destiny, we must consider what she says about time travel. If time travel can change the past, it allows serious paradoxes, such as the case Hermione Granger mentions of killing your past self before you could travel back and kill yourself. If you did that, you wouldn't have lived long enough to go back in time to have done it. You can't change the past according to the fixed time theory, and that means you won't kill yourself. You already survived, so it won't happen because it didn't happen. In Harry's one instance of time travel, Hermione and he travel back in time 3 hours, carefully avoiding being seen. They accomplish what they set out to do, saving Buckbeak and Sirius Black. There's never any indication of a change. The entire account fits nicely with what we already knew about that 3-hour period. We find out the second time around that later Harry cast the stag Patronus that saved earlier Harry from the Dementors. A fixed view of time fits this best. If Harry is saved by the Patronus stag the first time around, and then casts it the second time around, the best explanation is that Harry's later self was there all along. Yet future events cause those present actions, which means the future must happen a certain way for Harry and Hermione to have been able to travel back in time to do these things. A fixed view of time allows for this. Nevertheless, Hermione describes time travel in a way that allows changing the past.
We're breaking one of the most important wizarding laws. Nobody's supposed to change time. Nobody, she adds later. Professor McGonagall told me what awful things have happened when wizards have meddled with time. Loads of them ended up killing their past or future selves by mistake.
If we trust a trustworthy character reporting on another trustworthy character's statements, then in Harry's world, the past can be changed. That would mean time isn't fixed. It's highly unlikely that McGonagall is lying, or that Hermione misinterprets her, or lies about it to Harry. It's possible, but still unlikely, that the Ministry of Magic has spread misinformation about a guarded magical subject, and that even McGonagall doesn't know the truth. Some might find that a stretch. But the alternative, if the stories are to be consistent, is to take time travel in cases of changing the past as possibility travel and not time travel. They travel to another possible timeline. The one time travel case in the novels does seem to be genuine time travel, so it's not clear what mechanism would make it possibility travel in only past-changing cases. Aside from these puzzles about time travel, perhaps the most compelling argument for fixed time is that it fits best with current physics. Absolute space-time is often considered incompatible with special relativity. An open future requires an absolute present moment, after which little is fixed. But there is no absolute present. What we call the present is relative to a frame of reference. There can't be an absolute future if special relativity is correct. With a fixed future and prophetic access to it, Trelawney's first prophecy doesn't just happen to get it right, despite being unlikely. It is guaranteed to be right, even if many of the events along the path to fulfilling it seem unlikely. We might even conclude something stronger than simply that the future is fixed. Many unlikely events happen to lead to a prophesied event. A lot of chance events could have gone the other way to prevent the prophecy's fulfillment. Harry and his friends defeat Voldemort and his followers despite overwhelming odds, partly from sheer luck, and it fulfills a prophecy. That's hard to make sense of without a stronger connection between the prophecy and the actual future. It seems lucky that Harry and his friends have spent time in Moaning Myrtle's bathroom making Polyjuice Potion, which helps them locate the entrance to the Chamber of Secrets. They might have tried something different to figure out what Draco Malfoy knew, or might have brewed the potion elsewhere. Their choice of that bathroom allows Harry to find the chamber, save Ginny Weasley's life, destroy a Horcrux, make the Sword of Gryffindor capable of destroying further Horcruxes, leave behind the Basilisk Fang to destroy the Cup Horcrux, and alert Dumbledore to the fact that Voldemort must have made more than one Horcrux. A fair amount depends on where they happen to choose to brew that potion. Many other events that could have gone otherwise are crucial to things working out in the end. Harry's luck from Felix Felicis accomplishes a lot more than he realizes, including seemingly unlucky things, such as Dumbledore's death, but also his obtaining Horace Slughorn's memory of Voldemort wanting to divide his soul into seven pieces by making exactly six Horcruxes. Harry had that potion because he'd received Snape's former potions book, and that occurred only because Dumbledore failed to inform Harry that he could take potions, and Harry's change in circumstances with potions depended on Slughorn coming back to teach. In the second half of Deathly Hallows, Harry and his friends happen to be captured by the group that had Griphook. They arrive at Malfoy Manor during Voldemort's absence, after the fake Sword of Gryffindor was stored with a Horcrux whose location they didn't know. Snape had gotten the real sword into their hands for it to be there for Bellatrix Lestrange to see it and freak out, leading Harry to suspect that the hiding place of the fake sword also contains a Horcrux. Harry later arrives at the Shrieking Shrack just as Voldemort is about to kill Snape, allowing Snape to convey Dumbledore's last message to Harry. All of these events rest on luck. You might wonder whether some force guided things along to ensure that the prophecy would be fulfilled. The fact that so many chance events led to the prophecy's fulfillment might suggest the influence of some divine being. This would be a stronger destiny than merely a fixed future, because it involves the deliberate intentions of an intelligent being. Many Christians, for example, have interpreted the Potter books to reflect a strong view of divine providence, with God having a plan for the universe. That might mean God predetermines all of our actions by means of prior events causing them. But it could as easily involve libertarian freedom, as long as God knows what people would do in all possible circumstances, and therefore knows infallibly what free choices they may make. These lucky circumstances seem far too easy if there isn't someone guiding events towards certain outcomes. Such a view may not fit what Rowling intended to say when she denied destiny, and what Dumbledore says when he insists that Harry or Voldemort could have done something contrary to the prophecy. It's hard to be sure what Rowling meant, and what she meant Dumbledore to mean, but the story makes better sense if there is a deeper, providential explanation of the lucky occurrences. If not, Harry and his friends are just incredibly lucky. Part 2. The Most Powerful Magic of All. Chapter 4. Choosing Love. The Redemption of Severus Snape. Catherine Jack Deevil and David Paul Deevil. Although Harry felt a savage pleasure in blaming Snape for Sirius Black's death, easing his own sense of guilt, he can't get Professor Dumbledore to agree. In fact, Dumbledore finds Severus Snape completely trustworthy, despite all appearances to the contrary. It might be tempting to chalk up Harry's suspicion to emotional immaturity, but, other than Dumbledore, no members of the Order of the Phoenix trust Snape wholeheartedly. After Snape kills Dumbledore, Professor McGonagall murmurs, "We all wondered, but Dumbledore trusted, always." She continues, "He always hinted that he had an ironclad reason for trusting Snape. Dumbledore told me explicitly that Snape's repentance was absolutely genuine." With so many lives at stake, how could Dumbledore be so certain that Snape is loyal and trustworthy? In a word, the answer is love. Not Dumbledore's love for Snape, nor Snape's for Harry, but Snape's love for Lily Potter, Harry's mother. Although Lily doesn't reciprocate Snape's romantic love, Snape never stops loving her. And that love eventually leads, however circuitously, to his redemption. Enlightened contemporary readers might smile indulgently at the rhetoric of love and redemption, chalking it up to J.K. Rowling's sentimentality. After all, why think that love is a good reason to trust Snape? Clearly, Snape dislikes, even hates Harry, Sirius and others. Shouldn't Dumbledore worry that this malice might win the day? Furthermore, why think that Snape has been redeemed? Isn't his hate already evidence to the contrary? If he were redeemed, one might argue, then these feelings would be gone. Appeals to love and its transforming power are, of course, ubiquitous in literature, but aren't such notions, at root, just old-fashioned, quaint and simplistic? What would a philosopher say about such a thing? As it happens, philosophers have had quite a lot to say about love. They have explored the nature of love, the varieties of love, and even the way love can blind us and lead to mistakes in judgment. The Potter series, and Snape in particular, offers us a chance to explore these issues as well. Snape and the Many Splendid Thing. From Plato, around 428 to 348 BCE, to C.S. Lewis, 1898 to 1963, love has been a recurring and prominent theme among great thinkers. Whatever its source or ultimate significance, the Many Splendid Thing of love has served as the inspiration for poets and playwrights, novelists and essayists, philosophers and theologians. The prominence of love as a theme in the Potter books is hard to miss. Lily's love saves and protects Harry. Harry's love defeats Professor Quirrell and prevents Lord Voldemort from possessing Harry's soul. And Voldemort's fatal weakness, Dumbledore tells us, is that he never understood that love is the most powerful magic of all. In her refusal to water down love to something merely rhetorical or sentimental, Rowling joins some elite philosophical company. Greek philosophers distinguished between three kinds of love: eros, philia, and agape eros, or erotic love, is a type of love found in romantic relationships. Mr. and Mrs. Weasley, Ron Weasley and Hermione Granger, and Harry and Ginny Weasley are good examples of such love. In Western philosophy, the most famous analysis of erotic love is contained in Plato's Symposium, where Plato seeks to show how crude physical desires can be progressively refined to draw the soul upward to things beautiful and divine. Philia is friendship love. It's important to see that friendship is indeed a kind of love, rendering poignant and sad Dumbledore's observation that Voldemort never had a friend, or even wanted one. In fact, for ancient Greeks and Romans, friendship was generally believed to be superior to romantic love. The third type of love, agape, is universal, self-giving, and unconditional love. When the Gospel writers tell us that God is love, it is agape that they have in mind. Traditional philosophical accounts of love help us make sense of Snape's complicated character because they emphasize that love is not primarily a feeling, but a choice, an act of the will. Ideally, our emotions will be in harmony with what we understand to be the good, but we can act for the good even when our emotions rebel. The fact that Snape continues to have conflicted emotions does not prove that he has not been transformed by love. To the contrary, Snape's ability to act consistently for the good of others, despite his emotional indifference to or even dislike of these individuals, testifies to the strength of his love for Lily. The Abandoned Boys. Snape is an intriguing character, in part because he shares origins similar to Voldemort's and Harry's. Like Harry and Voldemort, Snape hails from a mixed bloodline, which raises suspicions and hatreds in parts of both the Muggle and the Wizard worlds. Desperate to associate himself with his mother's family, the Princes, and downplay his Muggle ancestry, Snape dubs himself the Half-Blood Prince. Having grown up in a home with feuding parents, Snape finds his first real taste of home at Hogwarts, again like Harry and Voldemort, using his magical powers and forming alliances in the wizard world. As Harry observes, he and Voldemort and Snape, the abandoned boys, had all found home there at Hogwarts. All three also tended towards Slytherin, with only Harry not ending up there. Of course, Harry and Voldemort took very different paths. Voldemort opted for power over love, selfishness over altruism, conquest over the vulnerability of friendship and genuine relationships of any sort. In sharp contrast, Harry opened his heart to friends and was willing to sacrifice himself for those he loved. Rather than choosing a fragmented psyche like Voldemort's, Harry allowed his friends to make him a better person of integrity and wholeness. Much ink has been devoted to the patterns of good and evil that Harry and Voldemort respectively represent. But what about this third lost boy, that complicated amalgam of darkness and light, Dumbledore's double agent and killer, Harry's protector and adversary? What makes Snape tick? Snape, the Occlumens. Snape is a complicated character, not simply because he is a double agent, but because his loyalties truly have been divided in the past, and his reason and emotions continue to be divided. Initially, Snape had been a Death Eater. After Snape's repentance, Dumbledore asks him to play the dangerous role of informant when the Dark Lord returns. To do so, Snape must gain Voldemort's complete trust. He must betray neither his loyalty to Dumbledore nor his pledge to protect Voldemort's enemies, especially Harry. His anger at, and sometimes hatred of Harry, and others, are real, but equally real are his constant self-risk and courage in fighting Voldemort. Snape doesn't choose to protect Harry and the other enemies of Voldemort because of great personal affection for them. The warm fuzzies associated with today's often watery and superficial notions of love. On the contrary, he chooses to act for what he knows to be their good, despite strongly disliking many of them. Love that is understood as the desire for the good of the other can be found not only in Rowling's depictions, but in writers on love who range from Aristotle to Aquinas to M. Scott Peck, despite the cultural and temporal distances among them. They share in common an understanding of love expressed in friendship as willing the good of another for the other's own sake. Over and over, the decision is stark in the Potter books between the option of furthering one's own apparent good at the expense of others, or sacrificing it for the good of others. Love requires self-sacrifice, binds one's happiness to the good of another, makes one vulnerable to loss and grief, and strengthens one's commitment to the good. These thinkers also emphasize that strong feelings become morally good or bad when they influence our reason and will. That is, when feelings affect both our understanding of what is good or bad and how we act. Particularly in Snape's case, love is not primarily found in feelings, but in actions. Love changes the course of his beliefs, alliances, and actions. He repents because of love, and he finds redemption by choosing to act for love. In short, it is Snape's love for Lily that primarily motivates the actions leading to his redemption. Once Dumbledore realizes that Voldemort and Harry can share each other's thoughts and emotions, he asks Snape to teach Harry occlumency, a magical technique for sealing the mind against magical intrusion and influence. Voldemort is remarkably accomplished at gaining access to others' thoughts and memories, making the detection of lies almost certain.
"Only those skilled at occlumency," Snape says, "are able to shut down those feelings and memories that contradict the lie, and so utter falsehoods in his presence without detection."
As Dumbledore's double agent, Snape regularly achieves what few manage, even once, successfully lying to Voldemort's face. Snape succeeds not only by intelligence and cunning, revealing enough information to appear to be a valuable informant while withholding the most significant points, but also by sheer magical prowess. Snape's skill at occlumency reveals both his strength and his weakness of character. The successful occlumens empties personal emotion, something Harry can't do. Snape fumes.
"Fools who wear their hearts proudly on their sleeves, who cannot control their emotions, who wallow in sad memories and allow themselves to be provoked this easily. Weak people, in other words. They stand no chance against Voldemort's powers."
Snape survives, not by giving up his love for Lily, the way Voldemort had renounced love and friendship. Rather, Snape conceals his love from Voldemort. Although this ability to hide memories and emotions is crucial to his role as a double agent, it also isolates Snape from friendship. The final chapters of Deathly Hallows reveal the depth of Snape's sacrifice and courage. As he lays dying from Nagini's bite, Snape transmits to Harry a flood of memories chronicling both Snape's love for Lily and his secret protection of Voldemort's enemies. Snape remains the consummate occlumens. His memories cannot be taken. They must be offered freely. Only when dying does he permit Harry access to his thoughts and feelings, revealing that Harry is a Horcrux and showing him what must be done to defeat Voldemort. Snape's choice. From childhood, Snape loves Lily Evans, although selfishly at first. He watches her with undisguised greed, while dreaming of Hogwarts as an escape from his family and a way of gaining acceptance in the wizarding world, despite his half-muggle bloodline. At Hogwarts, though, he is still an awkward outsider, now fighting with James Potter, for whom everything, especially magic and Quidditch, comes so easily. Worse, Snape knows that James is also in love with Lily. Snape's love for Lily begins to redeem him, ever so slowly at first. When Lily is a child, she asks Snape whether it makes a difference being muggle-born, to which, after hesitating, he answers no. When Lily is a teenager, having refuted Snape's earlier false belief in the superiority of wizard blood, she defends Snape against James and his friends, only to have the mortified Snape call her a mudblood. He apologizes, but Lily refuses to defend him anymore. With the friendship broken, Snape chooses dark magic and the Death Eaters. Later, though, he would remember this painful and costly lesson, and, as headmaster, rebuke Phineas Nigelus's portrait for referring to Hermione Granger as a mudblood. After dutifully reporting to Voldemort the prophecy he overheard about the child who would challenge the Dark Lord, Snape begs Dumbledore to protect Lily. Dumbledore asks,
"Could you not ask for mercy for the mother in exchange for the son?"
Snape assures Dumbledore he has tried, to which Dumbledore responds,
"You disgust me. You do not care, then, about the deaths of her husband and child. They can die as long as you get what you want."
Snape's love is not yet pure. He does not love Lily as what Aristotle calls a second self. Rather, He desires Lily's good as it relates to him. If he had desired Lily's good for her own sake, he would want to protect those most precious to her too. Snape relents, promising anything in return for Dumbledore's protection of the family. After Lily's murder, Dumbledore asks Snape to act on his love for Lily by protecting her beloved son. Snape's romantic love for Lily is tainted with selfishness at first, but his love deepens as he accepts the role Dumbledore proposes. Plato reflects on a similar deepening of love in the Symposium, which presents various characters attempting to describe and praise love. In the Symposium, Socrates' teacher Diotima claims, "Love is wanting to possess the good forever. This possession of the good is not the satisfaction of selfish desire in a superficial eros, which values the beloved for what he or she provides to the one who loves, but is instead a relationship to the beloved that draws the one who loves toward the beloved as a freestanding good. Someone who loves seeks giving birth in beauty, either to children or to ideas and virtue. Love opens itself to the eternal by extending the love of parents to their children, or by building virtue and love of what is transcendent in the one who loves." Rowling gives examples of both. Out of love, James and Lily willingly sacrifice themselves for each other and for Harry. Snape's romantic love for Lily, though unrequited, gradually does bring to birth virtue in Snape. After Snape commits himself to fighting Voldemort, the earlier selfishness eventually fades. Reflecting on the refinement of romantic love in the context of the Christian tradition, Pope Benedict XVI comments that "love looks to the eternal. Love is indeed ecstasy, not in the sense of a moment of intoxication, but rather as a journey, an ongoing exodus out of the closed inward-looking self towards its liberation through self-giving." Snape's love for Lily pushes him beyond selfish desire and changes him fundamentally. Snape's ongoing love for Lily, even after her death, spurs him to choose actions that gradually make his love more like hers, turned toward the good of others and capable of self-sacrifice. His love for Lily makes him place himself, like James and Lily, between Voldemort and Harry. A work in progress. Snape's decision to fight Voldemort and shield Harry remains steadfast, but his character doesn't change instantly. Here we see the damage of vice and the work of virtue. Both are habits built up over time. Changing one's feelings and behaviour requires vigilance and effort. Demanding that Dumbledore keep his role secret, Snape still rages at his schoolday tormentors, seeing in Harry all of James's arrogance and revelling in Harry's failures and detentions. Harry's physical resemblance to James blinds Snape to the shared character traits between Harry and his mother. Snape's patterns of behaviour and emotion continue to block friendships, but at least his actions unite him to the cause of those battling Voldemort. Snape also continues to share, partially, Voldemort's false assessment that those who guide their actions by love are weak. Snape spits this insult at Harry during Occlumency lessons. Harry is weak because he cannot lock away thoughts and feelings of love. Likewise, when Snape encounters Nymphadora Tonks's changed Patronus, he sneers, "I think you are better off with the old one. The new one looks weak." On rare occasions, a great shock or an emotional upheaval can alter a Patronus. Tonks has fallen in love with Remus Lupin, a werewolf, and her Patronus is now a wolf. Presumably, the wolf itself doesn't look weak. Instead, the change is evidence of her love, or, alternately, evidence that love has transformed her. It is this love, particularly of the despised Lupin, that Snape finds weak. But Snape's own Patronus, a doe, offers eloquent testimony against his assertion. Snape's love for Lily altered his Patronus to match hers. His strongest defense against magical threats is now an emblem of his beloved and his transformation by love, despite Snape's ability to block out his emotions and memories. Snape's Patronus reflects Aristotle's notion of the beloved as a second self. It is both a magical extension of himself and a manifestation of his love for Lily. Similarly, Harry is protected by the love of his parents. His Patronus is James's stag, and Lily's self-sacrificial love literally becomes part of his body, protecting him from Voldemort. In contrast, Voldemort protects himself by making Horcruxes. In love, one entrusts part of one's soul to another, in a fashion. A friend shares another's joys and sorrows and acts for his good, even when sacrifice is required. Friendship strengthens the soul's integrity. Friends become better people by acting for the other's good and building virtue. In short, loving makes us more fully human. But Voldemort entrusts his soul to objects which cannot share his joys and sorrows or require anything of him. With the Horcruxes, Voldemort has 8 selves, but each division of his soul makes Voldemort less human. Snape can act courageously, not because his previous beliefs and emotions have been thoroughly purged, but because he deliberately chooses to act according to love, in the sense of doing what's best for the other. Here, Harry's and Snape's courage are similar because, for each, an act of the will is required to forgo what he wants and consciously choose self-sacrifice instead. Harry shows that love conquers death by freely sacrificing himself. Rather than simply reacting, even virtuously, Harry chooses consciously. Harry observes how much easier death chosen in the moment, like throwing himself in front of a curse as his parents did, would have been. Similarly, Snape hasn't made his sacrifice for good in a single dramatic act. He has consciously chosen for years the perilous balancing act of protecting Harry while masquerading as a Death Eater. This task is all the more difficult, and clearly an act of will, because Snape acts primarily for the love of Lily, not of Harry. He wills Harry's good for the mother's sake, but he acts to protect Harry nonetheless. Finally, love is the key to Snape's redemption because it allows him to feel remorse, an emotion he shares with Harry but not with Voldemort. Evil acts damage the soul, but remorse can begin to knit it together, heal it, and make it whole. Snape's remorse does not in itself eradicate years of resentment. The difference is that he doesn't allow anger and hatred to decide his actions. Despite these feelings, he can choose to act for the good. These actions are a testament both to his love for Lily and to the substance of his redemption. Snape's love and remorse are manifest not primarily in his emotional states, but in his ongoing acts of the will to pursue the good of another. Harry shows remorse in forgiving Snape, purifying himself as well. Throughout the series, Snape and Harry wage a private battle, marked by guarded suspicion and outright loathing. After Sirius's death, Harry blames Snape for goading Sirius into rushing to the fight at the Ministry. Snape had placed himself forever and irrevocably beyond the possibility of Harry's forgiveness by his attitude towards Sirius. In the final scenes of Deathly Hallows, however, we see that Harry has forgiven Snape. Years later, Harry tells his middle child, "Albus Severus, you were named for 2 headmasters of Hogwarts. One of them was a Slytherin, and he was probably the bravest man I ever knew." Harry and Ginny name their children for people who fought Voldemort and chose to sacrifice their own good for that of others. James, Lily, Dumbledore, and Snape. Love does not transform easily or immediately, but what we see in Severus Snape is that love can radically transform a life. Snape doesn't get the girl, but his deep love for Lily changes his beliefs and actions. This love motivates Snape to persevere in his dangerous and lonely role of double agent. Through love, Snape is capable of self-sacrifice, like Lily and Harry. Chapter 5. Love Potion, number 9¾. Gregory Basham. In the Muggle world, people spend vast sums of money on perfumes, body sprays, cosmetics, jewellery, pheromones, body sculpting, skimpy clothing, gym memberships, tanning salons, diet programmes, and other means of increasing physical attractiveness and stirring romantic interest. In the wizarding world, there are far more powerful and reliable attractants, magical love potions. yet there are obvious ethical issues regarding the use of such potions, particularly the non-consensual use, as occurs in two key episodes in the Harry Potter stories. So, what do magical love potions have to teach us about love, infatuation, and the ethical treatment of others? In particular, what can we learn from Merope Gaunt's use of a love potion to ensnare Tom Riddle Sr., Voldemort's father, and her eventual decision to stop using the potion at great cost to herself and her unborn son? Violently Pink Products. Love potions not only make for fascinating thought experiments, they're also an important part of the Harry Potter plot. In Chamber of Secrets, Professor Lockhart at one point jokingly encourages the students at Hogwarts to ask Professor Snape how to whip up a love potion. And in Prisoner of Azkaban, Mrs. Weasley tells her daughter Ginny and Hermione Granger about a love potion she made as a young girl. But in Half-Blood Prince, we find several significant references to love potions. The first happens in Diagon Alley at Weasley's Wizard Wheeze's Fred and George's Magic Shop. Near the window was an array of violently pink products, around which a cluster of excited girls was giggling enthusiastically. Hermione and Ginny both hung back, looking wary.
"There you go," said Fred proudly. "Best range of love potions you'll find anywhere."
Ginny raised an eyebrow sceptically.
"Do they work?" she asked.
"Certainly they work, for up to 24 hours at a time, depending on the weight of the boy in question. And the attractiveness of the girl," said George, reappearing suddenly at their side.
So, in Harry's world, love potions are legal, apparently work only on males, although this isn't explicitly stated, vary in potency depending on the weight of the boy and the attractiveness of the girl, and work for only a limited time without a fresh dose. The next appearance of love potions comes at Hogwarts, in the newly installed Professor Slughorn's Potions classroom, where Hermione's showing her stuff.
"Now, this one here..." "Yes, my dear," said Slughorn, now looking slightly bemused as Hermione's hand punched the air again.
"Is that Mortentia?"
"It is indeed. It seems almost foolish to ask," said Slughorn, who was looking mightily impressed. "But I assume you know what it does."
"It's the most powerful love potion in the world," said Hermione.
"Quite right. You recognised it, I suppose, by its distinctive mother-of-pearl sheen."
"And the steam rising in characteristic spirals," said Hermione enthusiastically. "And it's supposed to smell differently to each of us, according to what attracts us. And I can smell freshly mown grass and new parchment and..."
But she turned slightly pink and did not complete the sentence. On the next page, Slughorn reveals more about this love potion.
"Amortentia doesn't really create love, of course. It is impossible to manufacture or imitate love. No, this will simply cause a powerful infatuation or obsession. It is probably the most dangerous and powerful potion in this room." "Oh, yes," he said, nodding gravely at Malfoy and Knott, both of whom were smirking sceptically. "When you have seen as much of life as I have, you will not underestimate the power of obsessive love."
Later, in Half-Blood Prince, we learn just how dangerous and powerful a love potion can be when Ron unwittingly eats a box of chocolate cauldrons spiked with love potion and becomes madly infatuated with Romilda Vane. From that episode, we discover that love potions act almost instantaneously, that they cause obsessive thoughts, intense excitement, and violent emotions, that they can strengthen over time, and that they can be cured by means of a simple antidote. So, what kind of person would actually use a love potion? In our final snippet from Half-Blood Prince, we are introduced to one, Voldemort's mother. Little Hangleton. Merope Gaunt, the local tramp's daughter, harbours a secret, burning passion for Tom Riddle, the wealthy squire's son. An unlikely pair, but Merope is a witch whose powers give her a chance to plot her escape from the desperate life she has led for 18 years under the subjugation of her father and brother.
Can you not think of any measure Merope could have taken to make Tom Riddle forget his muggle companion and fall in love with her instead?
Albus Dumbledore asks Harry, to which Harry offers two guesses, the Imperious Curse and a love potion. The Imperious Curse, of course, is one of the three unforgivable curses in the magical world. It robs victims of their will and is, as a result, a prime example of how magic in Harry's world can, but must not, be used to manipulate and exploit others, especially the most vulnerable. Love potions, we've seen, aren't illegal in Harry's world. Perhaps they're not considered as dangerous as the Imperious Curse, because they don't last as long, produce only romantic feelings, as opposed to, say, homicidal intentions, and don't result in total control of the affected person. But it's instructive that Harry sees a particular effect and correctly narrows down the likely causes to either the Imperious Curse or a love potion, reminding us of Slughorn's sober warnings of the love potion's dangers. After Harry's two guesses, Dumbledore continues.
Very good. Personally, I am inclined to think that she used a love potion. I am sure it would have seemed more romantic to her, and I do not think it would have been very difficult. Some hot day, when Riddle was riding alone, to persuade him to take a drink of water. In any case, within a few months, the village of Little Hangleton enjoyed a tremendous scandal. You can imagine the gossip it caused when the squire's son ran off with a tramp's daughter, Merope.
Dumbledore continues by engaging in some guesswork.
You see, within a few months of their runaway marriage, Tom Riddle reappeared at the manor house in Little Hangleton without his wife. The rumour flew around the neighbourhood that he was talking of being hoodwinked and taken in. What he meant, I am sure, is that he had been under an enchantment that had now lifted, though I dare say he did not dare use those precise words for fear of being thought insane.
After Harry asks why the love potion stopped working, Dumbledore adds,
Again, this is guesswork, but I believe that Merope, who was deeply in love with her husband, could not bear to continue enslaving him by magical means. I believe that she made the choice to stop giving him the potion. Perhaps, besotted as she was, she had convinced herself that he would by now have fallen in love with her in return. Perhaps she thought he would stay for the baby's sake. If so, she was wrong on both counts. He left her, never saw her again, and never troubled to discover what became of his son.
Harry then asks again whether it's important to know all of this about Voldemort's past, to which Dumbledore replies,
Very important, I think.
And?
It has everything to do with the prophecy.
What does this love potion narrative add to the story? And what might it have to do with the prophecy about Harry's defeat of Voldemort? Real love or mere infatuation? So, here's a question. Did Merope Gaunt, Voldemort's mother, love Tom Riddle Sr.? She was certainly infatuated with him, attracted to him, willing to go to extraordinary lengths to have him, but did she love him? Dumbledore says she did, but another possible answer is no, and here's the case for it. She didn't love him, or at least she didn't love him very deeply, exactly because she was willing to use a love potion on him. Presumably, a love potion, after all, robs a person of his free will. This is what makes love pills or potions an ideal thought experiment to elicit the recognition that real freedom requires more than doing what we want to do. Doing what we want to do may be necessary for freedom, but it's not sufficient. We must also have the freedom to do otherwise. Tom lacked such libertarian freedom. Some philosophers, including Harry Frankfurt, deny that the ability to do otherwise is necessary for genuine freedom. This view especially appeals to those who think that everything we do is strictly determined by the laws of the physical universe or by the sovereign plan of God. They typically accept compatibilism, the idea that free will is consistent with strict determination of all our actions and choices. Yet even compatibilists will likely deny that Tom Riddle Sr. freely loved Merope. Why? Because even if Tom was doing what he wanted by loving her, he wouldn't have wanted to love her as a result of a magical inducement. How much could Merope have loved Tom if giving him the potion deprived him of his freedom? It wasn't that she loved him too much. She didn't love him enough, if at all. It was selfish of her. She wanted what was in her interests, not his. She may have felt amorous affection or entertained an unhealthy obsession for him, but clearly she did not feel the deep love that respects the true interests and considered preferences of the beloved. Not only did she take away Riddle's freedom, enslaving him by the potion, she robbed him of the chance to grow in the relationship. And I use that term loosely, for although love can be one way, relationships by their nature are not. Merope didn't create a relationship that provided a context for Riddle to remain committed despite fluctuating feelings, to grow more in love as time goes on, to attain love's deeper reaches after the physical attraction and the initial excitement fade, or to become a better person as the rough edges of his personality get smoothed out in the mutual self-giving of a real and reciprocal loving relationship. No, she subjected him to magic that coerced his will into becoming obsessed with her. She could have treated him like dirt after that, and still he'd go on stupidly relishing and accepting whatever she dealt him, for that's the nature of the potion. This is surely a situation that invites abuse, but it's hardly a paradigm of love. Incidentally, this shows us what's wrong with using a love potion even on oneself to develop feelings for another, a person we perhaps deem worthy of loving. We're inclined to think it's at least not as bad to use a potion on oneself as it is to administer it to another person, because the issue of free will doesn't arise in the same way. By choosing to take the potion, our free will is intact. This isn't obviously correct, but suppose we grant it. Still, there's the other issue of becoming a certain kind of person. Think how easy it would be to take the potion, rather than working hard in the relationship to remain committed despite challenges, and to grow as a person through relational hardships. With all of the challenges removed, we would lose terrific opportunities to become better persons through the relationship. Not his mother's son. I could imagine that sort of story for Merope, and it's the direction I originally anticipated this chapter to go. It's no shock, I had figured, that a character so thoroughly evil and despicable as Voldemort would hail from such troubled beginnings. It's not a stretch that a man who never loved would have come from a loveless union generated and sustained by magic alone. Nor would it be surprising that a character who from his earliest years harbored such fondness for cruelty and domination would have a mother willing to coerce the will of her mate, and a father who would so callously neglect his child after the enchantment lifted. This view of Merope and Voldemort seems to make a good deal of sense. Its only drawback, so far as I can see, is that it's wrong. Especially where Merope is concerned, the contrast between her and Voldemort is far more important than the comparison. Voldemort's problem is not that he's his mother's son, which in many ways he isn't. No, the problem is that Voldemort is more like his grandfather, Marvolo Gaunt, and his ancestor, Salazar Slytherin. My point in excluding Merope from the list is that she illustrates how, in Harry's world, choices, not innate talent or biological ancestry or magical pedigree, most shape characters and destinies. Merope is a character who ought to elicit from us compassion and no small amount of respect. What she did to win Riddle was wrong, and radically so, but good people sometimes do bad things. It's not the occasional misdeed that defines us, but the habitual practice, the settled character, the persistent pattern of choices that put us on our life's trajectory. We are what we consistently do, as Aristotle put it. Her action was wrong, yes, but I'm not convinced she was very bad at all. To the contrary, she shows a remarkable character, all the more so in the face of all the obstacles she had to overcome and the temptations she had to resist. What matters is not merely where she ended up, but also the distance she had to travel to get there. What matters is the ultimate trajectory her life took, and not merely the projected track of her worst decisions. Unfortunately, Voldemort, if anything, ended up following in the footsteps of where his mother was headed until she came to her senses. Whereas she eventually stopped going in the direction of the dark side, he embraced it wholeheartedly. The blood of Slytherin coursed through each of them, but their lives went in diametrically opposite directions. If nothing else, this illustrates once more the primacy of choice in Harry's world. Critics have sometimes complained about the shortage of redeemed characters in the Potter books, but Merope is a prime example of one, a character whose background was as tragic as anyone's, whose capacity for misusing magic was as great as anyone's, whose temptations to engage in the dark arts were as strong as anyone's, yet whose life showed that not even a person like that is destined for darkness. And if even she wasn't, then Voldemort wasn't, for his upbringing was no more tragic than hers. If his destiny ended up beyond redemption, it was because his own choices, over time, forged a mutilated character from which there was no escape. Character may be destiny, but this makes more sense and is more just if character is the culmination of a truly free set of choices, rather than the inevitable outcome of blood or fate. This possibility of true freedom, of goods potentially but needlessly lost, imbues the Potter books with an element of tragedy that's often a feature of great literature. Consider again Merope's tragic home life, physical, verbal, and emotional abuse, a condition of virtual domestic slavery, an absence of love and affirmation, an abundance of violence and meanness. None of this makes her ensnarement of Riddle right, but, and this is part of Rowling's nuanced moral analysis, it ought to soften our critical judgment of Merope, especially since, of her own volition, she eventually gave up using the potion. At the risk of losing the love of her life, her unborn child's father, and perhaps the first happiness she ever experienced, at the risk of rejection and terrible pain, pain that did in fact practically kill her with a broken heart, she did the right thing, choosing character over power, reality over appearance, forgiveness over resentment. And she chose love over hate, letting Riddle leave because that was his choice, despite her continued love for him. Indeed, because of her love for him. And despite Riddle's abandonment of her, she still named her son after him, so gracious was her character. Which reminds us of Dumbledore's eventual gracious response to Muggles, despite their cruel and devastating mistreatment of his sister. Voldemort, in contrast, chose to exact revenge for his father's abandonment by killing both his father and his grandparents, and by rejecting his Muggle name and heritage. The contemporary philosopher William Hasker offers an analysis of freedom quite relevant to Merope's predicament. All sorts of experiences and relationships acquire a special value because they involve love, trust, and affection that are freely bestowed. The love potions that appear in many fairy stories, and in the Harry Potter series, can become a trap. The one who has used the potion finds that he wants to be loved for his own sake, and not because of the potion, yet fears the loss of the beloved's affection if the potion is no longer used. Merope came to a crossroads in her short, tragic life. Through magic, she could continue to manipulate Riddle, or she could stop, though at great personal cost. Merope did the right thing. She gave up using her magical powers altogether after Riddle left her, refusing to use them even to save her own life. It might have been grief that led to the loss of her powers, but Dumbledore is virtually certain that instead she no longer wanted to be a witch. Perhaps she saw its potential for abuse, especially within herself, and she refused to indulge it anymore. She may have recognized within herself the call to the dark side, as it were, and realized that the best way to avoid it was by renouncing magic altogether, never again subjecting another to the sort of tyranny that she herself had been subjected to by her family. She had experienced firsthand what that led to, and no longer wanted any part of it. Certain behavior can skip a generation. The child of an alcoholic not uncommonly sees the ugliness of the addiction and reacts against it, perhaps by becoming a rigid teetotaler, and then his children react against that, and the pattern recurs. Merope so reacted against magic and its abuses and retained such potential for love that she was willing to suffer and be vulnerable. Exhibiting what Voldemort could only think of as weakness, she was willing to fall prey to what he considered the worst thing of all, death. Merope chose the death of her body rather than the death of her character, and her own pain before the domination of another. Her love for Riddle had made her vulnerable to hurt and rejection, as all love does, and her aversion to hurting others the way she herself had been hurt contributed to her premature death. Not surprisingly, given her horrible upbringing, she lacked some of the good qualities that Harry's mother had. But nonetheless, Merope did all that she could to battle the forces of unforgiving fate to break free from the pattern of magical manipulation and coercion. In this sense, Voldemort is radically unlike his mother, who, despite her tragic history, still retained tenderness of heart and the capacity for love, whereas Voldemort never loved another, never even had a genuine friend or wanted one. And this wasn't because of his tragic beginnings, and certainly not because of his mother's moral failing, but, among other reasons, because he rejected the pain, vulnerability, and weakness that caring for another as much as for himself inevitably involves. He wanted to be untouchable, and he got his wish, losing his very humanity in the process. Remember that Dumbledore said that he wasn't as concerned about the young Voldemort's ability to speak to snakes as he was about his obvious instincts for cruelty, secrecy, and domination. Voldemort's abilities didn't define him. His choices did. And sowing his choices reaped a character and a destiny of darkness. He might have chosen not to love in order to avoid dependency or weakness, but his habitual unwillingness to open his heart to another led to the loss of his capacity to do it altogether. What we see in Voldemort is a picture of where the definitive choice of evil and the rejection of love lead. A character in love only with himself, but who ends up harming and fragmenting himself in irredeemable ways. Tragically, Voldemort learned from the worst his mother did, rather than from the best, hating what he should have loved, and imitating with reckless abandon what she herself rejected. All of this, of course, only bolsters the contrast between Voldemort and Harry. So much of what distinguishes Harry from Voldemort is that Harry, despite his troubled past and tragic life, never loses his ability to love. He doesn't harden his heart and start to care only about himself. He doesn't cut himself off from others. Far more than Voldemort, he remains his mother's son, the mother whose courage and sacrificial love keep Harry safe from the worst Voldemort can dish out. Her love unleashes a more ancient and powerful magic than any potion can hope to imitate, or Voldemort can hope to defeat, or even understand. Chapter 6. Harry Potter, Radical Feminism and the Power of Love. Anne Collins Smith. Love is a force in the Potter universe that crosses hierarchical boundaries and defeats the powerful. And, curiously, love is most efficacious in combating evil in J.K. Rowling's world, when it makes no attempt to compete at all. Self-sacrifice and kindness bring unexpected rewards. Love and compassion overwhelm greed and ambition, overcoming them without attempting to defeat them. In other words, Rowling's world resonates with the values of radical feminism. Perhaps that sounds strange. So, to demystify this claim, we'll begin with a survey of contemporary feminist scholarship on Harry Potter, en route to an understanding of radical feminism, culminating in an examination of the role of love in the Potter books. The feminist debate so far. Feminist commentators are divided on Rowling's series. Two general schools of interpretation prevail. Those who consider the series sexist and those who consider it progressive. Some writers, such as Christine Schaefer, Elizabeth Heilman, and Eliza Dressong, have argued that the Potter books perpetuate traditional gender stereotypes and reinforce negative gender portrayals in the minds of young readers. Jimena Gallardo-C. and C. Jason Smith, in their joint article Cinderfella, offer a startling and exciting feminist interpretation of the motifs and symbolism in the series. But they, too, claim that the books are sexist, at least on the surface. Other writers, For example, Edmund Kern, Mimi Gladstein, and Sarah Zettel have claimed that Rowling provides a balanced view of the sexes that includes strong female characters and an egalitarian magical society. They argue that the books are not sexist and indeed offer good role models for young readers. Although these two schools of interpretation are generally opposed, they are not completely black and white. Dressong, for example, offers a highly nuanced perspective on Hermione Granger's capacity for self-determination, even within a society that Dressong considers patriarchal. Kern willingly admits that the books are slanted toward male characters, even as he disputes the fairness of some accusations of sexism. This dispute between the two schools of interpretation primarily focuses on the portrayal of female characters in the series. In Harry Potter's Girl Trouble, Christine Schaefer observes that there are no female characters in the series who approach the level of the male characters. No girl is brilliantly heroic the way Harry is. No woman is experienced and wise like Professor Dumbledore. Elizabeth Heilman argues that the books replicate some of the most demeaning yet familiar culture stereotypes for both males and females. Gallardo C. and Smith claim that the Harry Potter books resonate with gender stereotypes of the worst sort. In response, Kern, Zettel and Gladstein offer eloquent pleas for the importance of context. They acknowledge the existence of female characters who display negative traits traditionally associated with feminine stereotypes, but they also observe that there are numerous parallel depictions of male characters who display negative masculine traits. Kern observes, for example, that the silliness of Lavender and Parvati mirrors the juvenile antics of Dean and Seamus, and that Hermione's accident with the polyjuice potion should be read in parallel to Ron's accident with the slug-eating spell. Zettel points out that Madame Pince the librarian goes irrational when she thinks a student has written in a book, but then Filch the caretaker wants the students whipped and chained for littering. Gladstein juxtaposes incompetent Trelawney with fake Gilderoy Lockhart. Expanding on their point by referring to characters not available to some earlier commentators, these authors also point to villains such as Dolores Umbridge and Bellatrix Lestrange, who command as much fear and respect as any of the male Death Eaters. Among the various negative feminine stereotypes, the act of giggling is a lightning rod for feminist commentary. Dressong comments that the pervasive description of girls as silly, giggling and light-headed undermines Rowling's more gender-balanced depiction of girls' opportunities in the patriarchal hierarchy. Heilman states that this giggling undermines the sportsmanship of the girls who play Quidditch. Even as sports team members, the girls exhibit girlish behaviour by giggling at the possibility of playing with the handsome new captain and seeker, Cedric Diggory. Quidditch is not the only context for giggling. The second two books are littered with references to giggling girls. Zettel acknowledges such criticisms and offers a pointed comeback. Critics deride the girls at Hogwarts because they're shown to giggle and shriek and generally make a lot of noise. Some real-life girls do giggle and shriek. Some are quiet and serious. Some like pink and ruffles. Some like athletics and blue jeans. We see them all at Hogwarts. I reject the notion that we must tell girls that the only way to be valid human beings is to turn themselves into boys. Radical versus liberal feminism. Although Zettel does not identify herself as a radical feminist, her response to these critics highlights a major point of disagreement between liberal and radical feminism. Liberal feminism, historically grounded in the writings of Mary Wollstonecraft, 1759 to 1797, Harriet Taylor Mill, 1807 to 1858, and John Stuart Mill, 1806 to 1873, holds the once controversial view that women are people, that is, intelligent, autonomous beings, and should be treated as such. Sometimes characterized as first-wave feminism, the feminism of the 18th and 19th centuries drew inspiration from Enlightenment philosophers, emphasizing individual rights and responsibilities, and arguing that these should be applied to women as well as to men. The liberal feminist view that women are people may seem entirely reasonable, but in actuality is surprisingly problematic. There's an inherent assumption in liberal feminism that people is a gender-neutral term. But in fact, Our concept of what people means has been shaped by a society whose intellectual life has long been dominated by men. Moreover, while liberal feminism is optimistic in its belief that women, given equal opportunity, will achieve equal status with men socially, politically, and economically, it overlooks the possibility that women may have interests, strengths, and abilities different from those of men, which may lead women to prefer different measures of success. There are examples of liberal feminism among both the supporters and the detractors of the Potter series. Gladstein, a supporter of the series, praises Professor McGonagall, who has succeeded in rising to a powerful position within the Hogwarts hierarchy. She also speaks in support of Hermione, whose logical acumen and love of learning fall into a traditionally masculine pattern of rationality and inquiry. These characters have succeeded on masculine terms, and their successes are rightly praised. Characters who have achieved different sorts of success, however, may not receive their full due within the context of liberal feminism. Gladstein, for example, highlights Molly Weasley's active and assertive participation in the Order of the Phoenix in the later books, but only briefly mentions her earlier role as a mother. We can also see a tendency toward liberal feminism in some of those who take a more negative view of the series. Heilman, for example, comments on Rowling's tendency to depict girl students in groups. This repeated grouping reinforces the idea of the sociological construct of the communal and friendly girl compared to the individual and competitive boy. She claims that this reinforces the inferior position of females, which suggests that she considers being communal rather than individual, friendly rather than competitive, as an indication of actual or perceived inferiority. This tendency of liberal feminism to downplay roles and traits traditionally associated with women is part of the reason that a different form of feminism, radical feminism, evolved as part of the second wave of feminism in the 1960s and the 1970s. Radical feminism takes its name from the Latin word radix, meaning root, and holds that the root cause of women's oppression is the sex-gender system, a set of social expectations that force identities onto people in such a way that a person's physical, sexual identification necessarily determines that person's personality, permissible social roles, and acceptable economic occupations. In a patriarchal society, these expectations will tend to privilege men and disempower women. For example, in the United States, within living memory, women used to be shunted into a handful of acceptable pink-collar jobs, such as nurses, secretaries, and school teachers. Although radical feminists disagree on exactly how to fix the problem, they often focus on the characteristics that are traditionally labelled masculine or feminine by society, and consider ways in which these characteristics can be freed from rigid categorizations, such as the following contrasted pairs. Traits traditionally considered masculine versus traits traditionally considered feminine. Control versus love. Independence versus interdependence. Individualism versus community. Hierarchy versus networking. Domination versus sharing. Competition versus cooperation. Aggression versus compassion. Reason versus emotion. Some radical feminists feel that our society would benefit from people in general becoming more androgynous, so that men and women could freely mix and match whatever characteristics appeal most to them individually. In this way, both men and women would become people. But our understanding of what people are would no longer be limited to the guidelines laid down by a male-dominated society. Other radical feminists feel that the values traditionally considered feminine would benefit our society most and should be adopted by men and women alike, thus shifting the definition of people to a more feminine-centric model. Some scholarly commentaries on the Potter series exemplify radical feminism. For example, Zettel emphasizes the importance of Molly Weasley's household management, pointing out that she's successfully raising 7 kids on a tight budget. Honestly, the woman should get a medal. In a more serious vein, Zettel argues that, for an author to show that only traditional male power and place matter, is to discount and belittle the hard and complex lives of our peers and our ancestresses. Zettel's willingness to praise female characters who have succeeded on terms other than traditional masculine ones would be welcomed by radical feminists. Another article that offers a radical feminist perspective on the Potter series is Giardo C. and Smith's Cinderfella. Although these authors criticize the gender stereotypes present on the surface of the series, they move to a deeper level to present a radical feminist interpretation of the good and evil sides of the conflict. The evil characters, they point out, display phallic power and ambition, and are aggressive and power-hungry. This would apply even to female characters such as Umbridge, who, despite her stereotypically feminine taste in clothing and office decoration, demonstrates an ongoing obsession with traditionally masculine values such as control, hierarchy, and structure in her takeover of Hogwarts, in Order of the Phoenix, and in her creation of her own bureaucracy to persecute muggle-born magic users in Deathly Hallows. On the other hand, Harry's own choices and decisions belie a preference for the feminine, and his compatriots exhibit traditionally feminine characteristics such as kindness, selflessness, a desire for intimacy with others, and responsibility. In this way, these authors argue that Rowling associates good with values traditionally considered feminine, and evil with values traditionally considered masculine. This association of good with qualities such as love and compassion is something radical feminists have in common with earlier philosophers and theologians, who also felt that such traits needed to be integrated into our understanding and practice of humanity. From St. Gertrude the Great's emphasis on loving-kindness as an essential feature of God's nature and a crucial one for humans to imitate, to Gandhi's campaign of non-violent civil disobedience, in which he proclaimed that life without love is death, to C.S. Lewis's careful analysis of each of the various types of love as necessary for the fulfillment of humanity, many thinkers have emphasized the importance of traits such as love, kindness, and compassion. Radical feminists argue not only that these traits have been traditionally assigned to women rather than valued by society as a whole, but that this has been done in a particularly harmful way. Women are encouraged to be so altruistic that they don't stand up for themselves, and they submit meekly to traditional forms of oppression for fear that any attempt at assertiveness will be seen as a lack of femininity. Meanwhile, men are damaged as well, because living up to a macho ideal that emphasizes competition and independence is a stressful and incomplete way to be human. As Heather Booth, Evie Goldfield, and Sue Munica wrote, as long as artificially constructed, mythically based images of masculine and feminine are the only alternative, both men and women are going to find conflict between their imposed sexual identity and their goals as human beings. More wonderful and more terrible than death. As mentioned at the outset, love, traditionally identified as a feminine characteristic, occupies a position of particular importance in Rowling's universe, and her depiction of it resonates with radical feminism. Again and again, we see Harry's capacity to love and be loved protect him from evil and enable him to protect others. We learn about the importance of love in the first book, when the love imprinted on Harry's skin by his mother's sacrifice saves Harry's life. Professor Quirrell, whose body Lord Voldemort inhabits, finds that he cannot bear to touch Harry because of the invisible mark left by the love of Harry's mother. This is the first example in the series in which we see that love resists evil effortlessly, without deliberate action on Harry's part. We then learn from Dumbledore that this same love saved Harry from Voldemort's earlier attempt to kill him in infancy. Love is not wielded as a weapon, it simply overwhelms evil by its very existence. This love, however, is extrinsic to Harry's own nature. In Sorcerer's Stone, he is saved by his mother's love for him, not by his own love for others. It is significant that this love is literally in his skin, on the outside, rather than, say, in his heart, on the inside. As the books progress, however, we see Harry's intrinsic ability to